let's go ahead and get started. We're a couple minutes after two, and more may wander in, or people may be feeling a bit sleep deprived after last night. And in our nocturnal adventures, I was going through actually and preparing some photos to accompany slides today in the PowerPoint that I'll be using, and I was going through some of my old photo stock, and this is not necessarily on the topic of reconciliation, but maybe more of rodents. I did come across this that I've always liked. We did not suffer from hamsters last night, but I, as a resident of the offending Chalet number 11, it was a squirrel or chipmunk that chewed through a wire and set things haywire. So the hunt is on, the nest has been discovered, the live trap has been sprung, and they are set anyway, and they're hoping it will spring over the course of the day. And meanwhile, don't light any fires near Chalet 11 because they had to disconnect us from the system. So, anyway, rodents are causing their share of problem, but here is one with perhaps a better message. But today, really, I was sitting in Jeff last session this morning thinking that this could just be a continuation essentially of what he was discussing. And we'll be taking a slightly more expansive view, but the resource that I'm using as a linchpin for talking a little bit more about at least one approach with a couple other additional insights from other places into how we might pursue some sort of reconciliation conversations surrounding politics comes from a book that deals especially with racial reconciliation. So Brenda Salter McNeil's Roadmap to Reconciliation. Salter McNeil has done this work over a course of many years, and she's currently teaching at Seattle Pacific University, inappropriately enough, Seattle. And she lays out a groundwork that I find fairly useful and fairly adaptable. So we'll be taking a look at that and what she has to say and how she has to say it. Again, looking at a couple other pieces of advice, information, perspective that might help us, again, to create a little bit of a framework, and then thinking about how this may or may not apply to the sorts of things that we've been discussing. So on Monday, we talked about some of the historical background for political polarization in the United States. On Wednesday, we took a look at Acts 15 as a window into the early Christian community dealing with different populations of people coming from very different contexts, trying to forge a Christ-following community, and what it took to be part of that community and how disagreements over barriers to entry, essentially, into that community animated considerable discussion and some dissension and ongoing debate, but also some level of agreement and the sorts of tools that they used. So those are things that we could draw upon and look back to. I realize that folks come in and out, as have I, all week in different sessions. So as we progress, if there are things that people are interested in seeking more information regarding, we can talk about that. But I'm going to spend some time going through Salter McNeil's perspective. Then we can perhaps do some discussing of how this might apply in the sense of addressing American politics. First, I wanted to start with the way that Brenda Salter McNeil defines reconciliation. Namely, that reconciliation is an ongoing spiritual process involving forgiveness, repentance, and justice that restores broken relationships and systems to reflect God's original intention for all creation to flourish. So this is not simply forgiveness, this is not even simply for a repentance, but this is a multi-stage process that has to involve some sort of coming together once again. Restoration. Some of the other lecturers have been talking about metanoia, about the idea of turning around, repenting, and reversing direction. And that is very much part of Salter McNeil's definition. And she predicates this on this idea that God's original intention is for creation to be diverse and for all of creation to flourish. She refers to the cultural mandate that humans receive in Genesis 1:28 to go forth and multiply. And argues that with multiplication and migration going forth and multiplying, diversity is a necessary consequence, that if humans are spreading out into all the world, that they're going to encounter different environments and deal with different situations and are going to develop their own cultural frameworks. So diversity and difference, she argues, is part of God's intention from the very beginning. This is fundamental to what it means to be human living here on God's earth, that we're going to be different people with different backgrounds. And again, she is addressing racial reconciliation in particular, but she creates a framework that is much broader in terms of its potential application. So I'm going to give you kind of the overview, then we'll get into each of these elements in a little bit more detail, and then eventually we'll put the overview back up on the screen so we have it to work with. And I hope it's on some level visible. She talks about the power of catalytic events to force either reinforcement of, in our case, polarization, reinforcement of previous notions, kind of a retrenchment of identity, or to kick people into a framework of reconciliation that's going to take them on a multi-step journey. So a catalytic event could be some sort of political crisis. It could be a racial encounter, a racially tinged encounter. It could be the sudden confrontation of our given situation with truths that threaten to collapse our previous understandings. That we're making assumptions, drawing on Jeff's lectured assumptions about white privilege, that in fact are damaging our capacity to reach out to the other and to become part of a larger framework of community. We can retreat into isolation as a result of that catalytic event. It can force this retrenchment, this firming up of boundaries. We can start building walls. All of this can take place in a preservation cycle that simply preserves existing frameworks and probably strengthens the boundaries on those frameworks. And she argues that this is, while one reaction that commonly happens, not something that ultimately is going to drive any sort of successful community in the long run. The other option is this cycle of transformation that is sparked by one of the catalytic events that we've already referred to. So that dawning awareness, there was a gentleman this morning in Just Lecture who referred to how all the rhetoric surrounding Black Lives Matter had caused an initial reaction in him that was becoming a very different sort of reaction as he listened to Jeff's commentary over the course of the week and as the gathered class attendance was talking about what it meant to have white privilege and about concepts such as Black Lives Matter and what that deeper meaning might be underpinning the movement, that initially he was kind of pushing back on that idea, and now he had a better understanding of where they were coming from. He's kicking into essentially this cycle of transformation, and certainly that would be something that Jeff was applauding, that I would applaud in this context as well, and the capacity for these catalytic events to have this kind of transformative result. So, and again, we're going to go through these in a little bit more detail, but she argues that in order for this catalytic event to have a transformative impact, and that this, again, is an ongoing cycle, that we're going to continually encounter things that kick us into this cycle, first we have to have a realization. We need to understand that we're living into a new reality, that our foundations have changed. Second, she argues for a stage of identification where your people become my people. There is a sense of dawning kinship. Third, in order for any sort of lasting change, we have to prepare for that lasting change. Something beyond kind of surface level identification needs to happen if this cycle is going to be complete. Otherwise, we're going to ultimately kick back, perhaps even into this framework. So we have to prepare for a lasting change, and that may sometimes be painful. And then finally, that we have to activate what we have prepared in the previous step and actively work toward reconciliation in our given contexts. So looks really cool in a diagram, it can be pretty difficult to work out in practice, obviously, and we'll get an opportunity to talk about that in a little bit more detail. But getting into the elements a little bit more specifically, this first stage of realization, she describes again as understanding a new reality, going through a season of preparation, hence this is, we've got this cross in front of our church sanctuary and the glass changes with the seasons, so I'm going with Lent for this, we're preparing. And so this is a fundamental reorientation based upon a realization that the reality that we previously were living in is no longer sufficient. And she tells a story of an astronomy professor who is speaking with the students. They have access to a planetarium, and he happens to have a student from Argentina this given semester. So it dawns on him that the night sky that the student sees is fundamentally different from the night sky that the rest of the students see, since he's living in the southern hemisphere. So he rejiggers the planetarium settings so that it'll show the southern night sky. And they talk a little bit about that, but there's this hole in the night landscape. And he eventually figures out that the planetarium equipment manufacturer has chosen to put the apparatus that connects the projection globe to its assembly right there. So the very bottom of the southern hemisphere is missing. It's a planetarium setup that basically privileges the northern hemisphere over the south, and consequently can't give a full picture. And she likens this to that awareness, stunning awareness, that we need to reorient our framework of understanding. So how do we see ourselves and others? How do we prepare, go through a process of readiness that allows us to create a fertile environment for examination and conversation? And then finally, this process, this step in the process involves restoration to the extent that we identify things to do. So what is our list of information that we need to gather, people perhaps with whom we need to discuss, resources we need to seek out? We've been talking a lot about media in this particular session, and I anticipate we will more this afternoon. But identify what needs to be done to try and create some sort of framework for conversation. The second step then, identification, this idea that your people become my people, can be tricky, and particularly when we're talking about political polarization, because it can be a pretty difficult concept to see someone with an ideologically polarized opinion to my own as my people, right? We tend to create these silos and boundaries. And we can talk a little bit, too, today about the extent to which some of this is possible or the conditions when it should be possible. But Salter McNeil calls upon the Book of Ruth and the famous passage about your people becoming my people, and Ruth choosing to throw in her lot with Naomi, even though her ethnic background was different. So this idea of trying to foster some sort of fellow feeling with people who are very different from us, culturally, politically, in any sort of environment of complexity. And then she argues that we need to create safe places. So again, some of the photos referring back to the sleep deprivation are a bit of a stretch, but safety patrol. Creating a safe space for having a conversation, a patrol, a set of requirements and frameworks for conversing. And a lot of this is pretty basic, the sorts of things that we learn in school to do and then don't always follow and rarely see enacted in the Twitterverse. But using I statements, identifying personally with our positions, refraining from interrupting, simply holding the space to have a conversation and listen to the other, maintaining confidentiality, being able to create a space where people can talk without fear of that conversation necessarily going further without approval. And then finally, being present, actually listening to what is being said. And I know that there are studies on the ways that people interact in different frameworks and what types of people are most likely to be spending their time formulating their next response. And certainly I know I can sometimes fall into that category, but taking the time to step back and actually listen to what is being said by the person with whom we disagree. So the third step then is preparation. This journey toward getting ready for lasting change. Solomon McNeil argues that this is the phase of her model at which communities with whom she works are most likely to stall out. And the reason for that is that people need to move from what she refers to as transactional sorts of change toward transformational change. So it's not enough simply to recognize, using the racial reconciliation example, that there are no people of color in an organization and hire some representative folks. That's all fine and good, but it's not transformative change. Perhaps changing hiring structures more broadly, or changing administrative structures, or fostering training programs that engage people in a very different framework is the sort of transformative change that needs to take place. She makes the argument that old beliefs and new beliefs can't really coexist once the new ideas are coming along, that those older ideas are always going to kick back in a time of crisis. Makes the analogy to new wineskins as well, the idea that the old ones will burst. So again, this is the toughest part of the journey. Requires us to operate in the midst of change, and can require us to wait. And that can be unsettling and uncomfortable. She refers, and this is something that I'm realizing that I meant to mention in the last stage. But it connects to the idea of transformative change. She shares a story of being on a trip with a group of churchgoers from the Evangelical Covenant Church, and they're traveling throughout the South, and it's a racial reconciliation organization tour. She writes, "One of the stops on the trip is a museum with a collection of graphic photographs documenting the horrific lynchings of black people in America. I'm sure you can imagine the impact. Looking at photo after photo after photo of young black men hanging from trees, or mothers hanging with their children, with white people often looking on in celebration, was intensely disturbing for the Sankofa group," and that's the name of this, this tour group. "Most of the group members couldn't speak. They got back on the bus in complete silence. There was a palpable tension. Finally, the white members broke the silence. Understandably, they were eager to defend themselves and put some distance between themselves and the immense brutality of what they had just witnessed. They hadn't committed these terrible crimes after all, and it was all such a long time ago. Then a black student stood up, in obvious pain, yet still calm, collected, and quiet, and announced her conviction that all white people are evil. Shouting and disagreement erupted, and it was unclear how the group would be able to move forward from this experience. Finally, a white female student stood up to speak, and everyone seemed to hold their breath. But instead of another version of, 'Please don't make me responsible for this,' she said, 'I don't know what to do with what I just saw. I can't fix your pain, and I can't take it away, but I can see it. And I will work the rest of my life to fight for you and for your children so they won't experience it.' She started to weep, and her mascara streaked down her cheeks, leaving dark trails. The bus was silent, and then my friend Austin said aloud, 'She's crying black tears.' She was indeed crying black tears. The black students on that bus now felt that someone identified with their pain and the experience of their people, and it was a profound moment of identification for all of them. Instead of trying to dismiss it or explain it, the young white woman cried in empathy and solidarity with the black students in her group. 'This is what it means to see from the perspective of others.'" So truly seeing requires being able to identify with a sense of empathy, perhaps without conditions. And again, this can be difficult to apply to a political situation. This very much reminded me of some of what was in the conversation this morning about the excuses that we, as white people, make when we're confronted with questions of white privilege. And certainly I've been part of those in my own congregation where I've been trying to stimulate some sorts of conversation about the legacy of church relationships with Native people and things like that, and can get pushback. Well, this wasn't me, I didn't do this. And she's arguing that the more powerful response is to say, I hear this, I take this on board, and I'll move forward. Now, when we're in a political realm, things aren't as cut and dry, right? There are differences of opinion that can be stark and based upon strong predicates. But to be able to say, I hear you, I hear where you're coming from, I recognize the issues that underlie even something that I fundamentally disagree with, can be fairly powerful, simply to allow for people to be heard. So getting back then to getting ready for lasting change, this transformative change. One of the things she points out is that it does, in a sense, take two to tango, and that's perhaps one of the more difficult questions that we face having any sort of conversation about pursuing kind of a politics of radical moderation, of trying to reach across the aisle from wherever vantage point we find ourselves. Because for lasting reconciliation to take hold, we are going to have engagement from the other. And sometimes that's a process of waiting, and sometimes that's a process of providing space for the other to recognize that we are actually listening, even if we disagree on some principles. This is an image from the Women's March in Portland, Oregon in January of 2017. And there were certainly plenty of signs where I was trying to edit out the nasty ones and things like that, because some protest signs are more productive than others. But I liked these. They're a little fuzzy here, but this says, "You belong here." And this, I probably can even read a little bit better. Yeah, "You have a gift to share," is what that second one facing the camera has to say. And while these were geared toward the participants and the people, perhaps the women or the people of color or the other minority groups who might be witnessing the march, I would like to think of this as extending more broadly than that, because ultimately we do all in some sense belong here, and we all have a gift to share, and that in itself can be a very unsettling and uncomfortable realization, to extend those a little bit further. But, and this is one of my favorite slash most distressing sculptures, she argues that the final step is activation, actively working for reconciliation based upon the stages that have been developed, this process of realization, of identification, of preparation, that needs to move into activation. And this is a statue of Jesus, obviously, from the Grotto, which is a religious sanctuary, a Catholic religious sanctuary, the national sanctuary of Our Sorrowful Mother, in Portland, not far from my home. It was created from an old rock quarry, actually. This Servite brother back in the 1920s wanted to create a sanctuary to the suffering Virgin Mary, Mother Mary, and took over this rock quarry and created a shrine that then has grown over the years. And so the statue dates from the 1930s. But Jesus really seems to be pointing in this statue in a way that beckons us to follow. And that's a little unnerving, because it's a pretty realistic statue. And it's also really big. It's hard to see here, but I'm standing way down here, and I'm tall, and it's looming above me. So following along on this, actively putting this process of not only preparation and identification, but active listening and so on into effect. So she argues that we need to communicate the truths that we are discovering through this process. We need to be advocates for the things that come out of this process. We need to relate to be able to create connections that will enable people to put our lessons to work, and then finally we need to educate so they have the information necessary to take these lessons on board. So again, this all, I'm going to argue, applies to our lives in the world of politics and the contemporary media landscape in which we find ourselves, and yet it's a more complicated fit than perhaps for something like racial reconciliation, where we can probably recognize a direction that we quote-unquote should be going. The world of politics can be more difficult because we do have different ideas about the best way to generate revenue, the best way to govern our economic system, the best way to provide for citizens. And yet, if we're listening, if we're preparing groundwork for communicating across boundaries, we're going to be able to develop a framework where we can actually engage not just the sort of soundbite positions, but the opinions and the perspectives that underpin those positions. Share stories and listen to stories. And I would argue that is going to be fundamental to what we engage in if we're going to have any success in talking with people with whom we disagree. This is an image from a ministry, I guess you'd call it, that I lead in our church congregation called Theology on Tap. And I inherited this. It was initially an intern project several years ago, and then a previous pastor tried to keep it going. He left. There was a need for new leadership, and I was asked if I would take it on, and it's been quite a bit of fun. We do a monthly conversation on a topic of that kind of is at the intersection of theology and contemporary life. So sometimes it's more topical than others. Sometimes we're talking about something a little bit more broad, like compassion. Sometimes we're engaging something pretty specific, like guns and violence. That was one of the more nerve-wracking ones, but it turned out well. Things like that that are really sort of work from the headlines type material. And we meet at a pizza parlor, and people can buy food and drink as they prefer, and then we have these conversations, and I provide them with a handout of questions and thoughts and reflections, maybe a couple quotations or some statistics, some biblical insight, and then let them go for an hour and see what happens. And it rarely goes in the direction that in my ideal heart of hearts, I would want it to go, because people are people with their own opinions and ideas, and they get sidetracked and everything else. And that's okay. That's something that I've come to see as part of the process, just to see where it goes. I figure at minimum they've got the handout to take home in the future. But it's proven a really fascinating model for generating some sort of discussion with people who sometimes disagree with each other. Despite the sort of Portlandia image of Portland, which is not untrue. There is a single stalwart house that still has Trump signs on it in the entire extended neighborhood surrounding my house, and I just have to wonder what kind of vandalism these poor people encounter. But they, the population of our church community is somewhat heterogeneous. There are people on different sides of the political aisle, and you can kind of see it happening in the conversations. But nobody has come to fisticuffs yet, and it's gone fairly well. And we try to generate conversation among groups of different people. It's an aging congregation, but you can see this is my daughter's 12-year-old friend and his dad and my sister. She's going to hate that I have that up there, but she doesn't know. And then people, they're a little fuzzier over here in their 70s and 80s participating in the conversation as well. That's very intentional. You'll notice that they all look like prototypical Lutherans insofar as they are more white people. And so we could certainly make some significant headway on that front in diversifying the conversation. But being able to have conversations like this, I would posit as another example of perhaps the direction that we might head, just to open the space for discussion and see where it takes us. But I wanted to note as well, under the rubric of changing the questions, another book that I've found provocative lately, and there's a sample copy in the bookstore, Alan Hilton's A House United, How the Church Can Save the World. no pressure whatsoever. Tells the story of a man named Ward Braim, who sponsored a church initiative to support an African micro-lending organization. So one of those not-for-profits that offer small loans to people to start businesses, purchase cell phones and coverage so that they can administer businesses, things like that. The kinds of dollar amounts that we would find very, very small, but that can be transformative. And he made an interesting point. Hilton tells the story that when we hear of people living on a dollar a day, or what is the new figure, is usually $1.90 about a day, I think that people will refer to, we tend to feel pity or we tend to feel guilt. Either, oh, these poor people, how can they do that? Or, gosh, I should probably not complain about my version of iPhone. You know, kind of the two extremes of this. And Braim recognizes those reactions as understandable and even biblical, that we should be caring for the least of these and seeking to address situations of structural inequity like this. But he also wants to learn how they do it. How do you live on $1.90 a day? How do you forge any kind of life, however poverty-stricken or difficult that might be? In short, they have skills that he, as an American businessman, lacks. And Hilton writes that Ward's questions changed our congregation's changed our congregation's question from whom should we include to whom do we need, and who are we missing around this table? And I thought that was an interesting approach. Hilton makes some pretty broad assertions for how people can work together, and it's a book that I certainly recommend, and it's a book that I don't agree with 100% in its entirety, and I think sometimes those can be the best kind when you're looking at something like as complicated as working across political and cultural boundaries, intracultural boundaries within the United States. But I thought that these were very provocative questions. Not just who we include in that sort of top-down sense. Oh, we're having a conversation, and you know, there has been a lot that Gary Mason, for example, has pointed out about maybe homogeneity in the population up here or in the church, our reluctance to engage with people of different backgrounds, whatever the context of that background might be. But rather than just seeking to find representative examples, thinking about the gifts and the perspectives that we actually need and who we might be missing, that resets that framework a little bit from kind of the going out and being the person of wisdom seeking the other role to being the person who recognizes that we have things perhaps to learn. And again, that can be really a difficult thing to swallow because in my initial gut instinct, I don't want to think that I necessarily need that opposing opinion. And perhaps depending upon the style in which it's expressed, we don't always need those expressions. But we probably need some of the perspective that underpins those expressions. Context is an important thing, and being able to create a framework where we've got sufficient context to have transformative discussions is going to be important. I was thinking as I was preparing today of a couple, there are kind of goofy examples of context, but they get at this idea that without shared context, meaning is going to be lacking, and that if we've got the framework for context, we can have even an insider sort of discussion if all these voices are represented. The very shirt that I'm wearing, this is a lithograph shirt. It is the entire text of Little House on the Prairie with a cabin on it, too. And so it's kind of a funky thing, and you have to look up close to see it, but I guess if I get bored, I can read my shirt, and that's fun. And it was something that my parents purchased for me because I'm named after Laura Ingalls Wilder, so there's a connection. But I was happened to be wearing this shirt, and I sat down for a meeting. I'm on the board of, or it's not a board, it's more of, it's a design advisory group, to use the bureaucratese, for the reconstruction of what will be my daughter's high school, which is also a school that I'm an alum of. And so there's been a bond measure, and they're trying to rebuild the high schools in Portland, and I'm part of this group advising them on how to structure the redesign. And I sat down, and I happened to be sitting down next to the high school librarian. So she took one look at me, and ooh, a lithograph shirt, which is that? She knew right away, right? She was a librarian. She was in on the sort of niche t-shirt market. And she knew the context. We shared a context, and we were able to have a nice little discussion about it. Years ago, I was in graduate school at UCLA, and my husband and I acquired a cat. And I wanted to name a cat Walter for reasons that I'll fully explain in a minute. And so it was a little male cat, and we named him Walter. And I came into the teaching assistant office, which was a shared office, the next day, and I said, oh, we got this new cat, and he's so cute, and here's a picture, and his name is Walter. And the first three people I told, bearing in mind this is the early 2000s, all said, and they were all about my age, so that would have been early 20s at the time, said, like Walter Cronkite? And I said, yes, like Walter Cronkite. The cat is named after Walter Cronkite, because I'm a political historian with somewhat geeky interests in post-World War II pop culture. And so Walter Cronkite retired when I was two. It wasn't something that was, and the others with whom I was talking were about the same age. But we were historians. We had a shared context. So we all knew who Walter Cronkite was, even if the average 23-year-old would not have done. And they guessed, without giving it a second thought, who, you know, I named this little cat after. Again, a goofy example, but it's shared context. And the idea behind changing these questions and thinking about who is needed and who is missing is to think a little bit about how we engineer conversations that are going to have enough shared context to start to really address important issues. I can go back and forth with people with whom I agree all day about a political topic, but we're not ever going to access the perspective. We're never going to understand the story of someone who comes from a different socioeconomic context, political background, racial context, whatever the criteria may be, we're not going to have that capacity. And once we have those people, perhaps we have the context for creating some sort of more fruitful conversation. And I realize this all can sound a little bit pie in the sky, because it's a lot easier to talk theory than it is to work things out in practice. I claimed on Monday that I didn't have the definitive answer, and it has not miraculously materialized over the course of the week, which I did not expect to be the case. But based upon everything we've discussed, for those who have been able to make a session or two, again, we can talk in a little bit more detail about what's been covered previously as well, as folks desire. And based upon thinking about this model, I want to talk a little bit about how we might do this in practice, and especially maybe thinking about the media landscape as something that is a recurring concern, it seems, as we've had our conversations, that the contemporary kind of daily me structure of people being in a position where they're gaining access to their own preferred information sources, and only their own preferred information sources, perspectives, topics, is something that lies in the way of creating any sort of intentional dialogue. How might we apply something like this, whether it's Salter McNeill's model or maybe those different questions? I should have probably poked those onto the same slide, but how do we go about something like this emergence of the daily me, of this fragmented media landscape where we're not hearing other perspectives? how might we use that as a catalytic event that would kick us into a cycle that would be more transformative than just preserving our little windows of perspective? Any thoughts? That's a really big, complicated question.
Maybe first of all, what might we need to do to start to develop some sort of new reality when it comes to the way that we engage with media as a culture?
I don't have an answer, but I have been confused about what do I watch on TV? I know most of the stuff I see on Facebook is worthless, but you know, I'm an age where I really don't care to go onto the computer to look at things, but I know there's a lot of stuff on there. But it frightens me that I don't know which is good material and which is fake news. Because apparently there really is some of that stuff.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it.
And I mean, how do you identify which is which?
Yeah.
I mean, seriously. I don't know. And so I listen to NBC or CBS. Mm-hmm. I don't even go to MSNBC, mm-hmm. if I can't say it, or Fox News. I don't know which one of those is liberal and which one isn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm almost frightened to go to either one of them.
Yeah. Yes. And typically MSNBC is viewed as the liberal perspective, and Fox News would definitely be the conservative end of the spectrum. But yeah, it can be a very confusing world in which we find ourselves, because there is that question of who and what we trust.
I mean, on that, there are, if you search, there are multiple places where they kind of show the whole gamut of who's out there and where they fall along the line. And you probably have to take that with a grain of salt, depending on who made the graph to. You know, because whoever...
I want pure...
Whoever makes the graph owns the data. But there are ones out there that I've seen that seem to be fairly...
How do you access those?
I mean, if you just search...
search what? I'm pretty basic.
Great news sources.
Great news sources, anything like, you know, anything
but
like that.
But then really go through, I mean, exactly what you're saying. Go through and look for what do I recognize as reputable. Not, who's this out here who came up with something and I don't know who they are.
Yeah, but if you do any kind of search like that just kind of asks about news source bias or news source liberal versus... conservative, and
it's a
rat hole. Yeah, you'll spend it.
I'd rather watch.
Rather watch Hanson Hamster. But there are ways. I mean, there are ones out there that pretty much still show the whole gamut of what's out there and kind of where they fall along the line.
So I saw one of those charts. I'm like, oh, this is cool. But then it showed NPR being very unbiased, which I thought NPR was known for being very liberal. So I don't.
No,
that confused me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
is NPR real liberal, or do
no.
people think it's real liberal?
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah.
Is that
conservatives would
is
say
that
it's very liberal.
Yeah. It's based on research, which
yeah.
some people don't like that.
Okay.
You know, that's what you
yeah.
have to
it, it does. I mean, I think it does give both sides, but it is educated people doing it who
yes.
do have their own bias. But I.
And I guess the other thing.
What you would? It would be interesting.
The other one that I kind of, just for my own benefit, is if I'm watching the news or reading something, do they make a very clear distinction between data they're presenting and opinion?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because if everything is, if you're watching them as, well, I think, if everything is I think, then to me that's interesting to know what they think, but you know, I got an opinion too, so... But if someone is showing facts and presenting material that way,
which can be twisted,
and every newspaper article, or every newspaper, every radio talk show, everything, they're all editorials to a degree, because somebody decided what was news and what wasn't. Nothing is inherently news.
Right.
So someone decided what was going to be important today, and what was going to be in the front page of that paper. So
right.
there's a degree of editorial comment in every one, because someone chose what to show you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all crap.
but that idea of being able to state that this is somehow based on research versus sort of I think cue is useful, very useful. I saw a hand in the back too, and I didn't want to. No. There's a really fascinating. It's an app, and I'm not sure if it's also a website. I imagine it is. Usually these things happen, but it's called Read Across the Aisle. Fairly simple. Just Read Across the Aisle. It's something that came out of this Cass Sunstein book, the unfortunately named hashtag Republic, that I've been drawing upon quite a bit. And it is really fascinating because the whole premise of the app is that it shows you, and again, it's always going to be from the perspective of, in this case, the application authors, but how the news that you're reading moves back and forth across the political spectrum. So there's a little window across the bottom that goes from red to blue, or blue to red, one or the other. And then there's a whole list of news sources, and you can go in and read news from various publications, everything from the avowedly liberal Huffington Post to the avowedly conservative Fox News and everything in between. And as you read articles, the little pointer at the bottom of the screen that's on the spectrum goes back and forth. So it'll show you if you're reading primarily conservative sources, your little cursor thing starts to drift toward the red side of the spectrum, and if you're reading almost exclusively liberal sources, it goes back toward the blue. And I've kind of gone back and forth trying to make it, but it's a fascinating idea. And again, it's coming from a perspective of an app developer, but with an intention toward fostering reading sources that are going to be diverse, intentionally diverse. And it's a fascinating window into the different ways that people portray information. It really raises the bar for us as citizens to be able to read and then interpret, make sense of this fragmented landscape, because we can't take something necessarily at face value. But it is one kind of useful tool for taking a look at all of this.
I'd just like to say that in trying to find what is a fact and what is fiction and what not, that it's easy to get caught up into that this is all going to be fake news, this is all going to be, so why bother even trying, it's not, so I think we need to be mindful of that,
mm-hmm.
and get past that
mm-hmm.
prejudice, which is there, that all this media is just out to tell us that what isn't true, because
mm-hmm.
that's a prejudice.
Yeah.
Against the media, whether you like it or not. So.
Yeah, it is. And it is something that perhaps is more of a contemporary problem because of the landscape in which we find ourselves. But I taught adult degree completion students several years ago now in a program through Little College, Warner Pacific College down in Portland. And it was a course on... You could sort of call it Introduction to Historical Methods. It wasn't my favorite style, and I didn't continue teaching in the program too long in terms of the approach that they were taking toward higher ed. But it was an interesting course in that every student had to take this course, and the idea was that you got a foundational framework of training in historical methods. But I was always surprised by the number of students who said that only experience, personal experience, conferred any sort of authenticity or credibility to something. It's a little bit difficult to be, certainly to be a medievalist, if you're only trusting your personal experience when it comes to any sort of history, even to do the work that I do. I can't go ask Richard Nixon what he thinks. All I can do is read his papers and shake my head. So I struggled with that to convey to students the need for some sort of trust in methods and in source citations and things like that. And in some ways that kind of connects to this idea that the media landscape is irredeemably corrupt. I kind of wish my 12-year-old was here to talk about expanding the framework of who's in the conversation, but it's a part of the middle school curriculum these days, even the late elementary curriculum, to identify and deal with fake news versus reliable accounts. And they talk about things like source verification and the types of language used in making claims, whether information seems to be reproduced over multiple accounts, many different elements that come into play in trying to identify a reputable source. That's just become part of their educational framework.
Can you teach us that?
Some of those things are, and like I said, I wish she was here because it's sure fresher in her little 12-year-old mind. But is the source coming from a position where other sources are cited? So is it a situation where officials or research documents or multiple accounts are referenced in a given story? In other words, are they citing people who seem reputable and multiple people who seem reputable, or research studies or sources of that nature? The difference between I think and citing sources is another really good litmus test for determining what is going to be some sort of factual information. And who is doing the I thinking as well. It's not that commentary can't be useful. An analysis analyzing something. But if we're talking about information gathering, probably to have somebody who is citing reputable sources over simply stating opinion, and who has the background and credibility to make that assertion. So if we're talking about vaccination policy. I was talking with somebody today and somehow the anti-vaccine movement came up. If we're talking about vaccination policy and the citations are coming from research studies and from medical professionals, that's probably going to be more reputable than somebody who has no scientific background in the field, or who is just a panelist on a television show who doesn't have specialist credentials. So looking for that sort of thing can be pretty useful.
I would say also, when I was going through school and reading articles, you look for ones that are peer-reviewed, or in like Scientific American or whatever.
Or flipping over to Google Scholar, which is a resource that's accessible to anybody, using Google Scholar, which you can get through Google by just typing in Google Scholar and then it pops you over, to be able to get access to peer-reviewed information.
Some things are fairly obvious. During the election and, all the talk about Obamacare, somebody my niece posted something on Facebook about some judge in Texas that on page something, something, something of the Affordable Care Act, blah, 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 this and this and this is true. And I just thought, that's just ridiculous. Well, I'm in healthcare. I've been in healthcare for over 40 years. So I looked up the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
And everything that was said on that article was just garbage.
Yeah.
So I typed my little niece a note and I said, you know what, I looked up those pages on the Affordable Care Act, and nothing of the kind was said about, that particular article is totally made up.
Mm-hmm.
Or in another instance, my family is very polarized. So my brother posts a picture of President Obama, and it says, this proves that he is a Muslim because he had a gold prayer curtain installed in his office. And I thought, so what did I do? I looked up pictures. I Googled George W. Bush articles or pictures in the White House, and so it shows George Bush signing legislation in front of this gold curtain. I mean, some of these things, if you just check other sources in addition to seeing if they're peer-reviewed and see who says it, you know, you can...
It's kind of like she said. She read the Nixon papers and then she shook her head. I mean, you know, there's the facts and there's the opinion.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. It was my own little commentary.
Yeah.
And what's in the Nixon papers ultimately matters more than my perspective on it.
We can all differentiate if we really want to.
Exactly. Although my perspective on it, probably as a historian, is going to have more validity than... you know, someone who just says, you know, Nixon was a bad, bad man, or something that, you know, we might come to a reasoned conclusion somewhere along that spectrum or not, but that's an excellent illustration.
So the other problem that we have in today's culture is that there are many people out there who will equate a strongly held opinion having as much validity as fact does, which is one reason I retired from healthcare.
I was in healthcare too.
yeah, and this can be difficult. And I'd argue that whether you're a historian or a, probably pastors encounter this too, or in something like healthcare, the existence of the search engine can be a very complicating factor in terms of people's access to information that may or may not be accurate in any way. So being able to think carefully about what voices we should be drawing into the spectrum is probably going to be a pretty significant early step in any sort of process of working toward reconciliation. And some of those voices... we need to be able to evaluate what is a credible conservative or liberal voice, for example, through methods such as just what we've been talking about, to be able to start to have any sort of productive conversation. And realizing the complexity of, in this case, the media landscape, may be one of those preparatory steps, just simply being able to appreciate what we have, and that there is something there that is complicated. Because, yeah, people can tend to equate opinion with reality in ways that are extremely damaging to any sort of productive conversation. All of this kind of gets back to what we were talking about on Wednesday with moving through the Jerusalem Council of Acts and the idea of respect for those who were speaking and looking back to other precedents and allowing for telling of stories, gathering perspective, that process and that method may matter as much as the ultimate outcome. Being able to engage in productive ways the voices that are going to have authority, that Paul and Barnabas had authority to speak to what was happening with the Holy Spirit among the Gentiles, because they had been part of that, they were the expert opinion, so to speak, in that realm. How I would posit that going through this stage of identifying with people of diverse opinions, of getting ready for any sort of lasting change, is going to require hearing stories from that position of sort of one foot inside and one foot outside of a given landscape. And something that might be a useful additional piece to bring in, the religious scholar Miroslav Volf, in his book Exclusion and Identity, talks a lot about cultural identity, and really that in many ways is what we're talking about when we're talking about politics. We have a series of cultures as a pluralistic society, and while we might be used to thinking of culture in an ethnic framework or a racial framework, we have a lot of different political cultures that animate our political discussion. He argues that we need to balance our cultural identity, which is important, with our broader identity as children of God. and the images that I have here, and so this is kind of an idea of 1 foot in and 1 foot out, so to speak, a dual role that as thoughtful Christians we might be able to play. This is from a trip, I alluded to this on Wednesday, but I was part of an Oregon Synod delegation last year that traveled to Poland for the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. We traveled to be part of the Polish Lutheran Church's, Church Day celebration in June of 2017. And they had this huge celebration. They were really into the Reformation. It's a church of 72,000 Polish Lutherans in a population that's 95% Catholic, and there are 38 million people in Poland, roughly. So you can start to get some idea of how minor a minority religiously they are. But they had created this framework for celebrating the Reformation that was far more influential than their numbers, and had a nationally televised worship service and all sorts of things going on that were making a little bit of a mark at this point on Polish society. And this was part of a session, it was an English language Bible study that we put on as a synod delegation with some input from Polish Lutherans. So the top picture is Pastor Michel Manicki, friend of mine who's a pastor at a church out in Canby, Oregon, and she was the one that our bishop asked to prepare the Bible study. And there were multiple reasons for that. She's a good pastor, she's an excellent educator, she speaks German, so she was super handy because more Poles speak German than speak English, and also she's female. And the Polish Lutheran Church does not ordain females. So the paper is obscuring things a little bit, but she wore a collar and was there giving this Bible study. And this was just a small group because it was people who were interested in engaging in some Bible study in English. But this was a witness without overt words, essentially, to something that the Polish presiding bishop is advocating for, namely ordination of women. And then, as our musical accompaniment, and we actually didn't know this was happening until we got there, it turned out that there was this group of Poles who were prepared to sing a couple songs. And they sang in both English and Polish. And they had this, so guitar, okay, that's fairly standard, and some women who were singing, and then accordion, because it's Poland. Mm-hmm. And so they launched into song, and I wish I could remember the specific song, but it was like a Chris Tomlin song. It was an American praise and worship song that they sang in Polish, and then they sang in English so we could sing along. It was just kind of a funny, bizarre cross-cultural thing with accordion. But the idea here is that we have this broader identity as children of God, whether we're crossing cultural boundaries as Christians in an international context, or crossing cultural boundaries within the United States, as people with a foot in our respective political communities, which is important. It's part of who we are and our identity, but that we also have this broader identity and consequent commitment as children of God to be operating in and among, here, this Polish Lutheran context, but also making a witness from outside with this more inclusive vision of what certainly leadership in the family of God might represent. Thoughts on this idea of how we might go about balancing individual identity with a broader identity, because I think that when we're talking about politics and we're talking about some sort of reconciling conversation, we need to be adept in our use of resources, we need to be listening for stories, we also have to be able to bridge this gap, figure out how we balance the communities of which we are a part with a broader commitment to a holistic framework and a holistic community. I have to find a way to talk productively with someone who is coming from a very different political context. And that can be difficult. But any thoughts on how how this plays into the process of speaking across political barriers or addressing political polarization? That's what I keep seeing, is the yarn going up, and then I keep putting you on the spot, so apologies for that. I don't want to be pegging you for something that...
Well, I think it's good that you have the communication, that you can share these things.
Mm-hmm.
You each bring something to the table. I'm thinking through this, going back to your diagram,
mm-hmm.
and reconciliation as change and whatnot. And the difficulty I'm having is that somebody's changing, and it's always, or it seems to be that the assumption is that they're going to change to my view,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure that's always appropriate. Is that some of that white privilege thing, or similar, that my view is right? Hopefully my brother-in-law is going to finally see the truth and come over to me.
Yeah.
So I'm seeing that and wondering from his side. He's trying to think, why can't, you know, when is Steve gonna see the light going to his side? So I see that dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think in the bigger picture, is change the goal? Is that we want to homogenize and get everybody together?
Mm-hmm.
Is unity the goal? Or are there situations where you have to live with it, with the difference?
Yeah.
And then the thought is, well, how in the heck can I do that?
Yeah.
How do I live with that difference? He's not gonna change. I'm not gonna change. But we're in a family together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that doesn't quite fit into the cycle.
It doesn't, and yet
so,
it's a really useful statement, because this idea of reconciliation, we tend to equate with agreement, and I think what you've hit upon is something really important, that when it comes to a topic like politics, there may not actually be agreement so much as some sort of better understanding that allows us to function more effectively as a society, and that maybe is the process when it applies to something like politics in this framework. Being able to have a conversation, being able to recognize that we do have differences of opinion without that demonization process, that may in itself be a transformative world, because if we can discuss things from a posture of perhaps better intentions, we talked a little bit about that earlier in the week, or be able to speak with some degree of recognition of another's stories, that could be a pretty powerful thing. I've got a friend who is tremendously interested in veterans activity. And she goes to our church. They live right across the street, so we can always see their vehicles. And she has a truck that is painted up just like flags and names and of like servicemen who are, there's a lot of text to read on one truck, so I haven't ever gone through it all. But it's just a, you know, red, white, and blue thing. And she's very dedicated to veterans programs. Well, it was easy for me the first time I saw that truck to draw a pretty extensive stable of conclusions. And as I got to know her, I learned more about her background as military draft, moving around extensively, and some of the difficulties that she overcame in her life related to some experiences with tragedy, and this whole context started to develop my understanding of where she was coming from with that truck and why that meant so much to her, why she went to the time and expense of creating a monument like this, a rolling monument essentially is what it is. And I still probably wouldn't concur with her opinions on politics in all respects. Although, as I've gotten to know her and her husband, I, you know, have been surprised many, many times and really enjoy both of them. But having those stories really has helped to provide a framework for recognizing. And so often I think we don't take the time to understand others' realities and forge those sorts of broader understandings, to take the time to listen to those stories. It can seem a little bit pie in the sky, but I would really advocate for the significance of that, that it need not result in a transformation of our own opinion so much as a transformation of our relationship to others' identities, that we can have some sort of deeper understanding. And from that, maybe we reach a point where we can say we need to do something about veterans in this context, and my approach is going to be different from your approach, and I disagree with some of the elements of your approach, but boy, I understand why you're doing it, and maybe here is a wedge of... Is the light flickering, or is that just me? Great, at least I'm not going crazy. But that maybe this is where we can operate, and we're still going to be of different political persuasions, but we can take part in this one segment of the spectrum. And I think that as much as anything, is where we could productively be going as a society. And that can be difficult. That might mean having conversations with completely, this is really getting creepy, but with different churches from very different backgrounds. That's actually something that, and this is where I struggle a little bit, and it's again, I commend it to you for reading and reflection, this House United book, but Alan Hilton tells of two churches from very different contexts who go and do domestic mission work. I believe they're both working in Texas and border communities. But they're going to do domestic mission work, and it was started by, I believe it was a much more conservatively oriented church who was taking on this mission work. And an extremely affirming church decided that they wanted to do the same work, and they actually partnered with this other community. And they have serious disagreements on how open and affirming their community should be, but they still are engaging in this sort of missionary fellowship work. And he posits that as a really good thing, and that's, you know, just coming from my 1 foot inside a community and 1 foot outside, I don't know if I could always be that able to overcome that divide in the same way, but it's something that they've been able to do, and thinking creatively about where our negotiables and our non-negotiables are, and how perhaps our witness unspoken can affect some long-term change. You know, it may well be that down the road one of those people from the less affirming church is going to have a relationship with somebody that changes their perspective. And that church's personal witness of being willing to enter into that uncomfortable position is going to bring some sort of some lasting change. There are different ways that we can be doing this kind of work, but it was a very thought-provoking element of his discussion. And he's gung-ho, Alan Hilton here is gung-ho on just, you know, interact until the cows come home. That's really his central message. And there's, even as we have to negotiate where our boundaries lie, it's a really provocative and potentially productive statement. There are going to be situations when reconciliation is not possible. Perhaps a party is not physically present to reconcile. Perhaps there are situations where the other party is, if not unable, then unwilling to even come to the table. And there may be situations, too, in which a black and white stance is the only acceptable conclusion. And thinking back to, you know, some of the information this morning with white privilege and racial reconciliation, yeah, some issues are more clear-cut than others. Tax policy is likely going to be a little bit fuzzier than recognizing the common humanity of people from different racial backgrounds. But being able to see nuance where we can is going to be pretty important. One thing that I would like to leave us thinking about, though, is whether there are situations in which reconciliation is more or less desirable. And seeing this against a framework of passages like in Colossians, when Paul writes right toward the beginning of the book in chapter 1, that through him, through Jesus, God was pleased to reconcile to God's self all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace through the blood of Jesus cross. And that's a pretty expansive statement on reconciliation. Are we called to reconciliation on that level, on that universal level? Are there limits to what we should be doing? It's a complicated question because it hinges up against the very edges of our identity and what we hold dear. Any thoughts on that? Are there points at which something like political reconciliation simply should not travel, or limitations that we face? Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking a year ago at the Charlotte, here, whatever you want to call them, where the guy ran over a woman and, you know, a bunch of young white men walked around with torches screaming, "The Jews will not beat us." I have, common ground, okay, that's all I have, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and milk, but your viewpoint is not welcome in the country I call my own.
Yeah. There are limits on the degree to which this can extend, that this is abhorrent. And that's, it's an interesting question in context of, for example, things that Gary Mason has said this week. I don't know if you've been present when he's argued that we need to be talking with white supremacists. And I take and appreciate that viewpoint. And yet, what is beyond the pale of civil society on some level? And can we talk with, attempt some sort of reconciliation work with folks without allowing for that to become part of our societal framework, saying, your position is outside the pale, I cannot accept this, this is not part of what the United States represents, and yet I'm going to have some sort of dialogue with you? It's a really complicated question.
Well, I forget the concept of it. It's kind of like there's no such thing as pure tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
Pure tolerance would tolerate the intolerant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And once you do that, you give a voice to the intolerant, and if it comes to power, all voices cease to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Except the one of intolerance.
Yeah.
There's a name for it, but it is a paradox too, but there's a...
Yeah, there is, and I'm not contradicting.
Somebody smart figured it out and named it after himself.
Probably, yeah. But if we are so wide open in our tolerance, we do run up against that problem. And again, connecting this time to Jeff, there was a video that he shared on Monday that essentially presented someone who was trying to be colorblind, and then it took it to a pretty ridiculous conclusion that if you can't see difference among people, then how do you effectively even provide for people? If we're colorblind, then how do we recognize the systemic injustices against African Americans in the country? And if we're blind to any other sort of disability, how do we provide for those who have disabilities to ensure that they are part of the framework of society and have access through the Americans with Disability Act or that sort of thing? That may be a limit at that point, that the conversation about tolerance and regard crosses beyond the pale.
Yeah, I've been reading articles that talk about how, because democracy, and I don't remember the detail of who it was, but thinkers who said democracy will be susceptible to being torn apart by this stuff. And and I'm getting more of an appreciation for the fragility of, for both the strength of our country, but also the fragility of democracy. And so it's a very hard line. I think of the free speech line, that you have the right to say anything, but you don't have the right to have somebody be hurt in the process, the fire in a movie theater kind of thing.
Exactly.
And so I just don't know, and maybe your perspective with history of politics, you know, where are the fragilities that we need to be careful of? Because mm-hmm. clearly we need to be open. I mean, this whole week has been about be open to the new mm-hmm. and open to the other. But what do we, you know, can you give any insight historically?
Yeah. It's the, I think back to things like the ways in which we have or have not allowed the basic institutions of our democracy to function, that really the only time when things fell definitively apart was when a segment of the country refused to recognize the success, the transfer of power, essentially, with Abraham Lincoln. Of course, it's a vastly more complicated scenario predicated on slavery and economic issues rooted in slavery. It all comes back to slavery in the end. But that refusal to countenance the working of the democratic process tore the country apart, the one and only time that that has definitively happened. And that is something that causes concern for me from a historical perspective is the fundamental respect for institutions to be able to allow our democratic institutions to continue to function even when that leads in a direction that we do not care for. And that's something that happened with regard to a significant percentage of the populace, and listening to the conversation, a significant percentage of probably those of us who are engaged in this conversation this week, in 2016, 2017, and the process continued to operate. Transfer of power was achieved, such as it is, but allowing for that to continue to function, that is the thing that causes me some concern. And that becomes somewhat conspiracist in its orientation, so I don't want to go too far down into that rabbit hole, but advocating for the basic functions of the way our governmental system works, I think, is a very important thing, regardless of where we stand on the political spectrum, because, you know, the next election, whoever you may be in the grand scheme of things, it may be you who is displeased with the way things turn out. But upholding those institutions, I think, is very important. That is one venue that both causes me concern and that I would uphold as extremely significant to continuing to function, to have hope for continuing to develop into the future pathways that might be more productive and more successful for us all. Yeah.
I think some people, I think, would argue too that even with FDR and some of the New Deal programs, some of the growth of government that happened in that period morphed our system too much into the government. And I think some of that happened is an issue today. Mm-hmm. With all of the bureaucracy and all of the regulations that run our government, that run the country. Mm-hmm. Now, there's this statistic I saw about in 2016 or 2015, I can't remember what year, but recently there were like 893 laws passed by Congress, but 19,000 regulations promulgated by all these, you know, alphabets and letters mm-hmm. that actually determine what happens in the country. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some people think that's not right. That's perversion of what the Founding Fathers wanted. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's happening now.
Yeah, I mean, the ways that, and that's, it's a good illustration too of just how fast sort of our fundamental institutions, which could seem kind of like a pretty basic framework, become really a complicated question, because there is disagreement about how things function relative to how they were initially set up, and it's something that people will come to different conclusions regarding. But yeah, how have things morphed over time? And we can talk about the imperial presidency, for example, being something that both FDR certainly notably expanded presidential powers, and then over the course of the the 1970s, that was something that Nixon attempted to do to varying degrees of success, and that other presidents since then have certainly tried to continue to expand. And it's encountered pushback from other institutions in government and outside. But yeah, how do we provide for policy that moves our government in healthy directions that are going to be more functional and maintain that system? We might have different opinions on what that looks like, but being able to attend to those basics, I think, is pretty important. And to see that there's been ebb and flow over time and that we may not have a perfect system that we're starting from in our contemporary realm. Yeah. Any final thoughts, questions? We've got a grand total of approximately a minute. Not that I can't stay around afterward, and we'll do. I also wanted to mention, I mentioned this on Wednesday, and I wasn't conjuring the name. And so this is the book on Acts that I was referencing fairly extensively when we were talking about Acts 15. It's called Intrusive God, Disruptive Gospel, Encountering the Divine in the Book of Acts. So perhaps some indication of the disruption in all sectors of our life that comes with trying to do this one foot in, one foot out life as Christ followers. Yeah.
Well, I was just wondering, getting back to the news again, maybe this is a silly question, but is it like PBS, would that be kind of a neutral, it seems to be more neutral than tuning into NBC or something like that. And my husband watches China News, and he thinks that is, you know, much more neutral than...
It's interesting to get news from outside, whether it's, regardless of
BBC or...
Yeah, BBC. I often look to BBC because there's interesting perspective. But to look at news, whether it's BBC or I've had friends and colleagues who have loved the Canadian broadcasting or, many different international broadcasters can provide some pretty interesting perspective because they're seeing things from a degree of remove, and they're able to perhaps look at things a little bit more analytically, even though they have their own interests and perspectives. My personal two cents worth would be that PBS programming tends to be very expert-driven, and that's something that I find appealing as a venue for seeking factually accurate news.
Two different viewpoints, anyway.
Yeah, but...
But thinking about PBS, it's publicly funded, mm-hmm. both by Democrats and Republicans.
What about the cop?
And so PBS has to put news out there that both will watch.
Hmm.
That's true.
It's like, we had to pay for our news. I was thinking about that ever since he said newspapers were expensive. We had to pay for our news instead of getting it for free through so many means.
Yeah.
We might get more of a moderate, more middle ground, we might move more to the center.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, because you're right. And thinking about some of the biggest still existing newspapers that have had reputations with pushback from significant groups of people, but like New York Times is beyond a paywall once you've hit 10 articles a month.
Washington Post.
Yeah, they're beyond a paywall after a certain limit of free articles. LA Times, same thing. So, and they're funding bureaus in other parts of the world. They're funding people doing the legwork to engage in deeper levels of reporting. So, yeah, that to some degree, this idea that we pay for is really a significant one.
Well, some of us do pay for PBS.
That's true. That, yeah. I can remember as a kid, like, every time they said thank you for your support, thinking, oh my gosh, are we, I was so nervous. Now I just do and make sure, and then I say you're welcome every time that comes up. I feel much better. But that is an interesting element, too, when it comes to something like public broadcasting. They do have this political dimension that causes them ongoing issues too, because they have to try and figure out how to not get so in trouble that they they get their funding cut, but on the flip side, that they are at least partially funded by foundations and by citizen contributions, puts them in a kind of a distinctive position.
One of the Koch brothers.
Hmm?
One of the Koch brothers has money on PBS, you know?
Yeah.
He's kind of talks about it being super conservative, blah, blah, blah.
And a lot of these people kind of hedge their bets, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah. And then like, the Koch brothers will fund reading groups at colleges. I had a colleague at George Fox when I was teaching there who was fairly conservative-oriented, but also a depth scholar. And he sponsored a reading group that was funded by the Koch brothers, but they bought free they funded subscriptions to The Economist for student groups. And then they had this little weekly reading group. They talk about The Economist. So a non-U.S., probably, you know, fairly capitalist-oriented, but nonetheless often pretty pretty broad spectrum of pretty informed journalism.
The Economist is non-U.S.?
Yeah, it's based out of Britain.
I didn't know that.
All right, so we're at past time, and I want to respect the many other things going on here, so, but I'll be up here for questions or more conversation.
Next door.
If you like.